Today is Thursday, January 30th. We are going to start with page 23. All right, so we were talking about blood cells, specifically about erythrocytes in here on class on Tuesday. Angela made a great comment about them looking like Smarties, and that's a really great way to visualize them. How would you describe the shape of a red blood cell?
Circular.
Circular, good. Are they the same depth all the way across?
No.
Where's their shallow point?
Middle.
In the middle. So they're fatter on the outside, and then they narrow down flatter in the middle. And would you say that they're flexible or rigid as they pass through your capillaries?
Flexible.
Very flexible. In fact, a red blood cell is the width of a capillary, and in some cases it's too wide for a capillary, and they will actually fold on themselves to fit through, and then they'll expand back up. So, you know, it is critical that they do have that flexibility. We also talked about the fact that they lack a nucleus in most organelles. Nucleus means they have no brain, right? So they have no way to repair themselves. That's how we get the directions for making repairs to a cell. So that is something to keep in mind. Because they have no nucleus means that they have no built-in brain, no way to repair damaged structures. They also lack most organelles. I kind of think of red blood cells as just drones. All they do is circulate your bloodstream, and they transport what? Yeah, oxygen and some carbon dioxide, right. So there's really nothing else to them that we're going to talk about. That's all they do is they transport those blood gases. Okay, so middle of the page there, you'll notice a term called hematocrit. And you'll see it's abbreviated as HT or HCT. And it's the proportion of the blood that is occupied by your erythrocytes or red blood cells. So in class last period, when we started this chapter, I mentioned to you that plasma makes up around 55% of your blood, and the other portion of your blood are formed elements, and the formed elements made up around 45% of your blood. And that's normal. That's if everything is balanced out like it's supposed to be. And then you see this and you say, well, hey, here is the normal value for erythrocytes, which is called the hematocrit, and it happens to be 45%. So let me go back. When we talked about blood volume, we said that 55% of your blood volume is blood plasma, and we said that 45% is formed elements. But there's more to the formed elements than just erythrocytes. We also have white blood cells and what else?
Platelets.
So what this tells me is they're very small numbers in comparison to what you have in terms of erythrocytes. This tells me that erythrocytes are by far the most common type of blood cell that you've got in your bloodstream, since they pretty much take up the entire population of your formed elements. So, normal value is around 45%. Males run a little higher, females a little lower. We know this is body size, and we also know that muscle tissue and testosterone drive this difference as well. Okay, so we can simply say, on average, for the human body, we're looking at around 45% of the blood being composed of erythrocytes. So instead of just saying all those words, I could have also said 45% of your blood is known as the what?
Hematocrit,
right. So see how those languages are interchangeable? I can say that 45% of your blood is made up of erythrocytes, or I could simply say 45% of your blood is on average the hematocrit. It means the same thing, okay? So we're going to think about those two terms interchangeably. Okay. If you want to measure your hematocrit, then we can do a centrifuge of blood and look at the portion occupied by what type of cells? Yeah, so if we want to know the hematocrit, just look at the red blood cell area. And, you know, if you're looking at something like a test tube, those red blood cells are heavier than anything else. And because they're heavy, they're going to sink to the bottom of that test tube. So on average, I would expect 45% of my test tube to be occupied by those red blood cells. Okay. There's a very small layer in between your red blood cells and the rest of the blood plasma, and that little teeny tiny layer is white or somewhat white in color, And that's called the what?
Buffy coat.
Buffy coat. So what else is in the Buffy coat?
White platelets.
Yeah, you got white blood cells and platelets in there. And they're approximately, 1% of that entire blood volume. So we're fudging the math here, aren't we? 55 and 45 plus 1 is 101%. That doesn't exactly work, but more or less we're saying that about 55% is plasma, 45% is hematocrit, and about 1% comes from those white blood cells and those platelets. So the top part here, when you do a blood centrifuge, is called plasma. And what percent of the blood is the plasma? 55%. Good. And what should we find in the plasma? Good. I hear it all. Waste, proteins, glucose, very important proteins such as albumin, globulins. They help us maintain blood pressure. The biggest part of your plasma is actually water. Yeah, so water is the largest component of your blood plasma. So just to repeat something we talked about in our last class period, anything that influences your hydration level is going to influence your blood plasma. Anything that influences your ability to make red blood cells will influence your hematocrit. And since we only can deal with 100%, these numbers can shift depending on how hydrated you are or on how much red blood cell you're transporting in the bloodstream. So let's think about this. What impact do you think that too much antidiuretic hormone would have on blood plasma? Too much ADH? You're retaining too much water. And if you have too much ADH and you keep too much water, what happens to your percentage of blood plasma? It goes up and your hematocrit goes down, right? So this is kind of where we want to think about this. If you've got a lot of water, your hematocrit looks less. Or if you are dehydrated and you've lost a bunch of fluids, what happens to this percentage, this plasma percentage? Now it goes down and your hematocrit level goes up, right? So we have to take those kinds of things into consideration if we look and see that numbers are drastically out of where they're supposed to be in terms of range. Okay, how about any questions on hematocrit? Makes sense? Right below, you'll notice that we're talking next about hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is the protein that's found in our red blood cells that transports oxygen. And it's a really specialized type of protein. In fact, it's a quaternary level protein, meaning it's reached the most complicated level of structure. And there's also 4 polypeptide chains in each hemoglobin molecule. There are 2 alpha chains and 2 beta chains. Well, the number 4 is what I'm going to stick with. There are 4 polypeptide chains here, and each polypeptide chain in this picture is a different color. There's 2 pinkish purple ones down below, and then there's 2 up top. Each polypeptide chain has its own heme group. Right here is a heme group, and what's important about that is sitting right there on top is an iron molecule. What is so important about that iron molecule?
Helps bind oxygen.
Helps bind oxygen, right. So keep in mind the number 4 is our magic number here. If we have 1 hemoglobin molecule, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 polypeptide chains. And if we look closely, there's in fact 4 heme groups. And how many total iron molecules?
4.
There's 4 iron molecules. To put this in perspective, 1 red blood cell will have about 250 million hemoglobin molecules. And each one of those can transport 4 oxygen molecules. So you're talking a billion transported by 1 healthy red blood cell. And then if you do the math, in 1 drop of blood, which is a cubic millimeter, a very small amount, we have 4 to 6 million red blood cells. The math is staggering how much oxygen we're transporting and burning off at any given time. If you take that math and then you say we've got 5 liters of blood, a little less than half of it's red blood cells, it's a number that we probably don't even have a name for, right? We've got so much oxygen in transport in our bodies. In fact, most of the time, you're just transporting oxygen bound to these iron molecules on the heme groups. And at any given time, do you know how many oxygens unbind and go out into your cells and tissues? Should you dump all four at a time every time a red blood cell circulates through your body? You won't even dump off three. You won't likely dump off no more than two or one every time one circulates past body cells and tissues. So what that tells us is we're rich with oxygen. We've got a lot of oxygen in transport at all times because it serves as a backup supply. So at any given time, you're going to look at probably all four of these iron molecules sitting there with oxygen bound to it. That way that if you have a need for oxygen, you've got an immediately available supply. Okay, so the number here that is magic is four. If you look down below, you'll notice there's a blank for us to fill in. The number of molecules of oxygen we can bind by a single hemoglobin is four oxygens. So we know the rules here. We know that if we're highly oxygenated, which we probably are at this moment right now, we are carrying a lot of oxygen. That oxygen is bound to the iron molecules on the hemoglobin, and we have what is called oxyhemoglobin because the iron and the oxygens are bound together for transport. It is a bright red color when we've got oxyhemoglobin. But if we start dropping off a bunch of those oxygens, then our iron molecules actually take on a dark red color, just like a rusted tool in the garden. Okay, so we've lost those oxygens, the iron becomes a dark red color. So when we lose oxygens, we actually have deoxyhemoglobin, and that means that we're putting those cells, or putting those oxygens out into our cells and tissues. What do you think your cells do with this oxygen? Make ATP, right. So what might you be doing to increase demand for ATP?
Exercise,
right. So that might be one thing that encourages more of those oxygens to unbind from those hemoglobin molecules. Something else to think about is temperature. We'll talk about that a little later in respiratory, but temperature plays a role here. Your exercise level plays a role here. You know, are you in acidosis or alkalosis? Those kinds of things can also influence what we're doing with those oxygens. All right, so carbon dioxide may bind to hemoglobin, but you'll notice it's a different area. It's not going to take the seat occupied by the oxygen. That wouldn't be very fair, right? Carbon dioxide is a waste product. It should not take a seat away from life-giving oxygen. So it binds to a different location, and that is to the amino acids on those hemoglobin chains. This is not the most common way for carbon dioxide to hitch a ride back. It'd be like seeing a semi driving down the street and trying to grab onto the back door and hang on as you go, right? Probably not the preferred method of transport. But nonetheless, some of our carbon dioxide molecules can hitch a ride and travel bound to those amino acids on the red blood cell. So going back to this picture, those carbon dioxides will not hit that iron for a ride. They'll hit somewhere else on these hemoglobin chains. So interesting little animation here. You'll notice the whole entire thing you're looking at is a hemoglobin molecule, and it looks like it's shifting. So imagine that every time oxygen binds to a hemoglobin molecule, the whole molecule shifts, making it easier for more oxygens to come for a ride. So it'd be like every time you take your car, your doors would automatically open when you walked up to it, making it very inviting and very easy for you to get in. So that's what hemoglobin does. Hemoglobin says, I got a ride, you wanna come with me? And so one oxygen hops on, it says, look, I got another ride, come with me, until it's got all four irons bound with oxygen. And that's where we want to be. We want to be fully saturated. All right, so why do you think it's a bad thing to ride around deoxygenated? What's that? You might not get enough oxygen. What else?
Some cells and tissues will die if they have enough oxygen.
some cells and tissues will die. And if you're riding with the bare minimum, it doesn't take much to die, right? So it's always good to have an extra in reserve. It's like riding with a full gas tank all the time, because no matter what happens, you've got a little bit of reserve built in there to that oxygen supply. Let me put it to you this way. When you come into this building, I'm pretty certain you climb stairs somewhere in this building. You don't start breathing heavy with the first step, do you? It may be 10 steps before you start to see an uptick in your breathing, right? So what are you using for those 10 steps? You're exercising, right? You're using your reserve supply. So once you start burning off that reserve supply, your body says, oh, I don't like to ride empty. Maximize, put all four oxygens on those hemoglobins. And that's when you start to see an uptick in your breathing rate. Okay, so that's kind of where your reserve supply builds in a little cushion for you there. All right, how about any questions about page 23? So what's my magic number for oxygens bound to hemoglobin?
Four,
good.
A couple of things to highlight, top of page 24. Normal red blood cell count is 4 to 6 million in a cubic millimeter of blood. That's about a drop or so of blood. So 4 to 6 million. Second thing to highlight is how long they live, about 120 days max. They will start dying off anywhere from around 70 days old until about 120. You know, you're going to be constantly recycling these populations, replacing them with new red blood cells. So here's a thought. Why don't they live very long?
They can't divide.
They can't divide, right. Once you've made a red blood cell, they have no brain, they have no nucleus, so that's it. When they get worn out, they are snagged in your spleen and your liver, and there, of course, is where they're broken down. So your liver and spleen have some spongy tissue in there, and if you have a ragged, old, dying red blood cell, that spongy tissue will catch those red blood cells as they circulate through. And so those damaged or worn out, inefficient red blood cells are trapped, and that's where we start the recycling process. It is critical that you recycle, because if you don't recycle, you're constantly having to replenish your iron stores, your heme stores, and you're constantly having to remake your proteins. So it doesn't take much to deplete your iron stores. You know, hemorrhage can do it. Females who menstruate oftentimes have problems managing their iron stores. So we want to reclaim and recycle that iron as much as we can. The heme group becomes bile ultimately. We do get rid of that through another process, but it's not like we just get rid of it and say, hey, you're not needed. We actually are going to recycle and reuse that one particular component. And then, of course, we don't want to constantly have to be eating other proteins to make new hemoglobin molecules. We are going to recycle those amino acids and reuse them. So most of it here is actually either going to make something else or be recycled into a brand new red blood cell. So our bodies are rather efficient at making our new blood cells from old ones. Interesting thing here to think about, when bile is broken down, you know what color bile is, right?
Orange.
Yeah, kind of a yellowish, greenish color. If you break that down further, it becomes a brown color in your feces, which is the whole reason that feces are brown. And any of that broken down bile component in your bloodstream becomes yellow, and that's where your urine comes from, that yellow color from urine. So the color of urine and the color of feces both are based on, ultimately, the breakdown of a red blood cell, and then to some extent that bile molecule. So interesting how colorations on us are so driven by the red blood cell. Even jaundicing and bruising is coming from the damage of a red blood cell. All right. So since we are constantly recycling and getting rid of red blood cells, we are also going to be constantly making them. And the fancy name for making new cells is called hematopoiesis. Boy, what a name, right? And hematopoiesis involves not just making red cells, also white blood cells and platelets are involved here. And we do this in the red bone marrow of our bones. So if you're thinking back to Bio-210 for a moment, red bone marrow is housed in the spongy tissue of our bones.
and in the marrow cavity of some of our larger bones like the femur. So red marrow is where we're doing this process of making blood cells. There is a what they call a stem cell, so progenitor cell, that gives rise to all of our blood cell types. And this is a name you'll want to know. A hemocytoblast gives rise to all blood cell types. That's about dead center of the page. Hemocytoblasts are stem cells that give rise to all of our blood cell types. This is a family tree. You might think about red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets in the red bone marrow. And you'll notice at the top of the tree is that hemocytoblast right up there. It gives rise to all types of white blood cells. You can see their lineage starts here and works their way down to the bottom. And then here's the red blood cell lineage. Now, with this lineage, if there's any problem with the stem cell way back up here at the top, what does that do to your white blood cell and red blood cell populations?
Decrease.
It could decrease them, right. Sometimes a problem happens at this next level, and if there's a problem at the next tier, then we may have wacky numbers. Sometimes people with leukemia also have anemia. And you say, well, but the real problem is the white blood cell. But you see how they're all occupying the same space of your bone marrow. And if one number gets out of whack, it may in fact cause the other populations to get out of whack. So the problem is we have to go through a maturation process. We take these immature cells, we divide them, and we make these more mature cells that you see down here at the very bottom. If you're pumping immature cells into the bloodstream, can they do their jobs properly? No. So unfortunately, if you have these immature ones that are being pumped out into the bloodstream, that can impact the levels of the other healthy cells, and then the whole blood gets out of whack because of this kind of a domino effect of having one set of cells that aren't being produced properly. So that hemocytoblast is certainly critical since it does give rise to all of our cell types, red cells, white cells, and those platelets too. I'm going to pick specifically on the red blood cells because they're our conversation right now. And we're going to bring back, guess what, a hormone into the conversation because this is all hormonally driven. Okay. Do you know the organs in your body that filter blood, produce urine, get rid of waste products? What organs are those?
Kidneys.
Kidneys, good. So your kidneys know what's going on. That seems to be a great location for us to monitor oxygen levels. So in fact, it is in your kidneys that we're going to not only get rid of waste products, but also detect and see if oxygen levels are proper. All right. So if there is low oxygen level in the kidney has a hormone that it produces called EPO. And that one stands for erythropoietin. All right, literally translate that into red. What about poietin? It's like to make. So we're literally making red blood cells in response to the presence of EPO or erythropoietin. Well, the kidneys don't make blood cells, do they? What part of your body does make blood cells? Red bone marrow. How do hormones get from your kidney to your bone marrow?
Bloodstream,
like every other type of hormone, right? So we let that EPO leave your kidney, circulate in the blood, reach your red bone marrow. And in response, your red bone marrow will now increase red blood cell production. So people with kidney failure, yikes, can they monitor their oxygen levels properly? So if they're not monitoring them properly, maybe their kidneys also don't make enough EPO. And if you don't make enough EPO, what might the result be?
You don't make red blood cells.
You don't make red blood cells, right. And we're going to learn that's called anemia. So that's an unfortunate side effect of having kidney failure is we get populations of cells that are not properly produced. So as long as you've got red blood cells dying on a minute-by-minute basis, we're always going to have some red blood cells in production to replenish those lost ones.
But, you know, if there's major losses of oxygen, we're going to see this mechanism help to kick on and produce more red blood cells. But here's the catch. You don't just get red blood cells immediately. How long does it take to produce new red blood cells once EPO arrives at that bone marrow?
3 to 7 days.
Okay, so you'll notice that on your worksheet there, about 3 to 7 days is how long it typically takes for us to make new red blood cells. You ever go to the mountains, walk around, feel a little bit winded, and you start thinking, gosh, am I really that out of shape? And then the whole time you're there, you feel awful. Go home, you feel fine. Okay? How long would you have to stay in the mountains to feel better? At least a week. So if you went for the weekend and you feel really winded, you know, just enjoy, right? Because it's not going to be until about a week later that you may actually get a little more kick up in that red blood cell population that's in circulation. So kind of sad there that it takes that long, but nonetheless, we're always making new red blood cells because they're always being destroyed and lost. But EPO helps us in times where there may be a little drop in that that red blood cell population. So I want you to notice on your sheet, about halfway down, it says key here. It says it's not the number of red blood cells in the bloodstream that controls the rate of erythropoiesis. It's how efficient they are at transporting oxygen. Okay, and so you may have numbers that look out of whack. Maybe they're too high, for instance. But if those red blood cells aren't properly transporting oxygen, you could double the number and still not do a good job at delivering enough oxygen to meet your cells and tissues' demands. So it's not the number that's necessarily the critical thing here. It's how effective or how efficient those cells are in transporting oxygen. Here are some things that we need to make red blood cells. There's a couple of blanks for you to fill in. We need iron, of course. We poorly absorb it through our gut, so you've got to be sure you keep what you get, right? We also need vitamin B12, which we will talk about later. It comes through our foods, especially meat products, into our body, again, absorbed through our digestive tract. And another B vitamin is called folic acid. We get that from grains. So we'll need these kinds of dietary supplements to help us make proper populations of red blood cells. Okay, so iron, B12, folic acid. All right, so down at the very bottom there, there's our hemocytoblast. I do want to mention the reticulocyte for just a moment. I'm going to go back to our family tree. You'll notice that this family tree starts up here with some cells that have a very dark purple nucleus in them. And then all of a sudden, down near the bottom of our red blood cell family tree, we don't have a nucleus anymore. So this cell here, I know you probably can't see the word, it says reticulocyte. That is an immature red blood cell that's kicked out of the red bone marrow and put out into circulation. Give it a few days, it will fully mature into a functional red blood cell. But for the short time being, just a few days there, it's along for the joy ride of riding in your blood plasma. It's not transporting oxygen yet. It's not quite fully developed. But think about the bone marrow is pretty full already. So the bone marrow says, hey, reticulocyte, you're almost ready to be a grown-up red blood cell. Get out. And so it kicks out of the red bone marrow, travels for a few days as an immature red blood cell. Give it a few days. It's now a full-fledged, functional oxygen transporting red blood cell. So I mention that because if they want to know how well you are preparing new red blood cells, they'll measure your reticulocyte level and not your erythrocyte level. Okay, so which population is constantly dying?
Erythrocytes.
Erythrocytes are constantly dying, right? The up and coming, the tomorrow generation, is not your erythrocytes, it's your reticulocytes.
So that gives you an idea of the birth rate of red blood cells.
Exactly. Yep. So if you want to know what tomorrow's numbers will be, they're the ones you look at. So do you see any advantage of somebody getting EPO injections?
What will it help them do? Yeah, make red blood cells, right. So the important thing here is that they transport what blood gas?
Oxygen.
And that oxygen is used to make ATP. So that's the link there between getting EPO injections and getting a little more energy. All right, so that should do it for this page 24. How about any questions on that page? Have you all done the white blood cells in lab?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel pretty comfortable there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll just do a rundown on those. The white blood cells have a lot of different functions, everything from fighting infections to forming antibodies. They are the ones that can divide. They have nuclei, they have organelles. They may or may not have some little sacs in their plasma called granules, but that's one thing we use to distinguish them from one another. They can travel by diapedesis, which is a process by which they walk across the capillary walls of your body.
Creepy.
Creepy, yeah. So they're like ghosts that wander into your cells and tissues, and they can get back in your bloodstream and ride. That is completely different from your red blood cells. They're only trapped for travel in your bloodstream. But yeah, these are creeping along. They're moving about into your body's cells and tissues. They've got to be on patrol to help get rid of anything that might be there to eat us or harm us. Notice the normal numbers here, far, far less than red blood cell counts. You'll know this number for the test. You'll want to highlight that one. 6,000 to 9,000 is way less than 4 to 6 million. Okay, so way less, 6,000 to 9,000 per cubic millimeter. Some live for a few hours to a few days. Some are memory cells that live for way longer. They, of course, remember what you've encountered and are prepared to fight it even 20 years later. But a lot of these things are going to be short-term. They eat a monster that's in your body, like a bacterium, and then they die from it. But that's okay, because some are built to be replenished on a pretty quick basis. There's two groups. You probably have seen these in lab. They're the granulocytes and agranulocytes. They are distinguished by the presence of granules in their cell cytoplasm. And of course, those granules are nothing more than little sacs that are typically filled with a chemical. Sometimes they're easy to see, sometimes they're hard to see. And we can stain the white blood cell with a particular chemical to make them show up better. That is actually where we get the names from. When you look at the list of names here, like eosinophil, basophil, and neutrophil, that is the stain that they love. They're stain lovers, okay? So the eosinophils, which are in fact the granulocytes here, love a red stain. Phil, of course, means to love. They love a blue stain. And the neutrophils love a neutral colored stain. So that's where their names come from, is what stain they particularly favor, and it makes their granules show up a little easier. The agranulocytes don't really have visible granules, although you are seeing a few here in the background, but for the most part, they're much bigger in size than a regular granulocyte, and their jobs are a little different as well. So let's run through these for just a moment. Let's talk first about the granulocytes and hit those neutrophils. Neutrophils are the most common type of white blood cell. You'll want to make a note by that. They are the most numerous white blood cell. Neutrophils are the most common white blood cell. But caution, right? They're not the most common of all of our blood cell types. That honor goes to what?
Red blood cells.
Yeah, that's red blood cells. So neutrophils are the most common white blood cell, but you know, you're talking about a really small population of cells in the first place. Most of our granulocytes have a lobed-shaped nucleus. Looks kind of like a kidney bean or a sausage. This particular neutrophil here has three lobed-shaped nuclei pieces. 2 to 3 is common in a neutrophil. Neutrophils also have a neutral stain-loving set of granules, but to be cautioned, that may appear somewhat pink, or it may appear somewhat light blue or even light purple in color. And that's the case with this picture.
So the colors are kind of, I don't know, they don't lie, they lie to you sometimes. They don't really tell you the truth. So I would really look hard at those lobe nuclei, because neutrophils have traditionally 2 to 3 lobe nuclei. Now, everybody else in this picture is what?
Red blood cells.
Yep, this is all red blood cells. So if you have neutrophils present in a particular part of your body, what are they there for? Yeah, they fight infection, they eat bacteria. So if you ever go and say to a doctor's office or a PA or whatever and say, I don't feel good, and they determine that you have some kind of infection, they may prescribe to you some type of antibiotic that will hopefully kill what you've got. Not all antibiotics work on every single infection. So give it 2 weeks, you may be back at that office saying, you know what, I took that entire round of antibiotics, I don't feel any better. And they may now say, well, let's run a complete blood count and see what's going on. If these cells, these neutrophils are elevated, they'll at least know that you've got a particular bacterial infection. May not know what bacteria it is, but they'll say, well, at least we know it's not viral or, you know, parasitic or something of that nature. This narrows the scope for us and says it's a bacterial infection. All right, so we're looking for 2 to 3 lobe nuclei. That's exactly what we've got here in this neutrophil. And you can barely see the granules in the background. So like I mentioned, they're kind of, they're hard to look at because you get a pink one. Here's a purplish blue one. So I really look for those lobe nuclei when I'm looking at a neutrophil. All right, the next one on our sheet is called an eosinophil. It's a red stain lover. I don't know, that might be red, huh? What do you think? But one thing to notice is look how those eosinophil granules almost completely cover that nucleus. They're so populated in there that it's very hard to see this bilobe nucleus. That is the classic sign for an eosinophil. Not 3 lobes like you commonly see with a neutrophil, but just 2 lobes. And the granules, if you can see them, they're going to be red, kind of like what you see here. There's the bilobe nucleus, just cram-packed full of those eosinophil granules or sacs. So you'll notice their job is not necessarily to fight bacteria. They are fighting, but what this time? Parasitic worms, yeah, allergies, things like that. So yikes, if you've got tapeworms, if you have some kind of persistent allergy to something, we'll tend to see those eosinophils increase instead. Basophils typically stain blue, and they are also chock full of granules, so much so, once again, that you can't really see the nucleus. But these are classically a bright, brilliant blue or purple in color. There's lots of these granules here, but they're full of a chemical. What is it? Boy, have you ever had a histamine reaction?
Uh-huh.
Miserable, right? Hives, yeah. Oh, God, awful, right? If you haven't had full-body hives, maybe you've had a bug bite that just won't stop itching, or itchy eyes from, say, allergies, inflamed nose when you've got allergies. So that's all histamine reactions. So if you happen to have a bug bite that won't stop itching or whatnot, we often take histamine blockers. Do you know a common drug that people take to block histamine?
Benadryl,
yeah. Makes you feel dopey as heck, right? Histamine, interestingly, is also a brain neurotransmitter, so that's why you feel woo when you've had an
antihistamine.
You got a hangover from it, right? So, interesting, these are the least common white blood cell, but they can kill you. Okay, so if you have anaphylactic shock from, say, peanut allergies or a bee sting that you're highly allergic to, these things can release so much histamine that they can cause your cells, or your capillaries rather, to leak all their fluids out into the surrounding cells and tissues. Guess what happens to your blood pressure when your blood leaks out?
Down, down, down.
Down, 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 right. So you have shock from it. So these things are vicious in terms of what they can do to our bodies, killing us. All right, last two here are lymphocytes and monocytes. They are, of course, agranulocytes, meaning what? Don't have granules, right? So no granules present in their cytoplasm. There are some, you know, they're hard to see. We're just going to assume that there aren't any there. That makes our conversation easier. But notice for the lymphocyte that it's got a pretty sizable nucleus. It does stain dark, and it takes up almost the entire size of that white blood cell. So when we talk about lymphocytes, we should remember a word that goes with them. What do they make?
B cells, T cells.
They do make B cells and T cells.
Produce antibodies.
Bingo, antibodies, right. So when we started our conversation about blood, I talked to you about white blood cells sniffing us out and checking to make sure we are our own bodies. That's the lymphocytes and some of their gang. They do produce the antibodies in response to foreign antigens. So now we can have a full circle conversation about how white blood cells are checking out our red blood cells. Okay. Then last, finally here, are these monocytes. Their nucleus is also large, but note, it looks like a Pac-Man. Okay. It has a little open mouth right there. And that's because monocytes love to eat. Okay, so they look like a Pac-Man. Monocytes are big eaters. In fact, they're called macrophages. What does macrophage translate to? Large eat, right? So these things migrate through your cells and tissues outside of your bloodstream, and they eat stuff. So they're cleaning up our bodies basically kind of as a trash crew. They're constantly eating and cleaning up. In fact, they may in fact eat viruses and other things that can cause them harm. If they eat the Epstein-Barr virus, then we may end up with mononucleosis or the kissing disease, right? So they may themselves become sick with their own garbage that they're eating.
Great.
Yeah. So these are your garbage guts. So how's your comfort level with these? We're not going to target pictures in lecture. That's just lab only. Are you okay with these? Okay. Last, at the very bottom of the page, are these itty-bitty platelets. And I really shouldn't call them a cell. Those platelets are, in fact, cell fragments. So they're pieces of cells. Let me explain them to you this way. When platelets form in your red bone marrow, imagine a really big cell like this one here, this huge cell here exploding. So if you've ever blown up a balloon beyond its capacity and it pops and now you've got shards of balloon everywhere, that's what happens to a megakaryocyte that makes those red blood or platelets. So they are shedding pieces constantly. Those pieces are going to be those platelets that go into circulation. All right, so the normal platelet count in your bloodstream is about 150,000 to 350,000. Okay, so here we have that number, 150,000 to 350,000. They're not really true cells. They certainly don't have a nucleus on their own. They cannot repair themselves. Their lifespan's even shorter than most others at about 10 days. So you know about never let monkeys eat bananas, right? Okay. All right, so what we have left is blood disorders on 26 and blood clotting on 28. I'd ask for y'all to read over page 26 as homework. Most of that information is just straightforward facts about anemia, polycythemia, leukemia, and leukopenia. Do you have any questions on that page? Right, because if I say you've got low blood count and you have an iron deficiency, you'll want to be thinking iron deficiency anemia, just a definition for them. Yeah. Okay, any questions on that page? I'm going to leave that one for y'all to read if you haven't yet had an opportunity. And instead, I'm going to take you through 28. That'll be our last new material. The fancy word for blood clotting is hemostasis. Literally translated, hemo means what?
Blood,
good. And how about stasis?
Stop and stand still.
Stop and stand still, right. So it's not that we want our blood to stop flowing, we just don't want it to escape through a damaged blood vessel. Don't confuse that term with hematopoiesis, they're both fancy and sound strange. So hemostasis literally means blood stopping or blood standing still. Now, if you happen to have a blood vessel rupture, we could pump blood into our internal body cavities and never even know it. It's obvious if you've got an external bleed, you see the blood coming out of your body. But you know, if somebody's in a car accident, they may have internal bleeding and we never see that blood. But we have to, of course, check to make sure there's not blood being hemorrhaged into an internal cavity, into the brain, or other places like that. If we're losing blood, we lose blood pressure, and we lose the ability to deliver what gas to our cells and tissues?
Oxygen,
right. So whether it's an internal hemorrhage or an external hemorrhage, we have to make sure we're delivering enough oxygen by fixing the problem or even giving blood transfusions to bring blood volume back up to normal. These three steps here should allow us to stop the bleeding, like the name implies, right? So we're going to start with the first step of fixing this problem by doing vascular spasms. The next step is called platelet plug formation. The final step's a little more complicated. It's called coagulation. Let me caution you here. Coagulation is not agglutination. You'll want to make sure you keep those two terms straight. Coagulation has to do with stopping the bleeding. Agglutination is what process? So who's attacking who? In agglutination? Yeah, antibodies attacking antigens in agglutination. So I just want to make sure we see those two words are different. We will not want to get those two confused, right? Okay, so let's start with the first process. I'm sure that we've all had a nasty paper cut at some point, so let's think about a paper cut that we've got. The very first thing that happens that you may not be aware of is that blood vessel begins to constrict. That constriction process is called a spasm. The word vascular spasm implies blood vessel spasm. So what do we gain by having that blood vessel spasm? What do we hope to keep?
Blood.
And we hope by squeezing that vessel, less blood can escape through the area that's constricted. So you'll see right here that vessel pinches or constricts, and that should slow the blood through that vessel. Now, people know to apply pressure, right? If you happen to have a major damage to a vessel, applying pressure does the exact same thing. It puts a squeeze on that vessel, and again, it prevents blood from traveling through and hopefully prevents blood loss. Okay, so that's going to happen immediately. The second thing that's going to happen is this. It's called a platelet plug formation. So why are platelets involved here? What do they do for us?
Clog the hole.
Clog the hole, right. We use them for clotting blood. But they're not the final part of blood clotting. They're just a step of blood clotting. When you damage a blood vessel, let me go back to this previous picture. Do you see these fibers hanging down? Okay, so it'd be like, you know, damage to your roof and all of a sudden insulation is hanging out of your roof. Normally you don't see that stuff. Likewise with a blood vessel, you normally don't see those fibers hanging there. Now, when we damage a vessel and those fibers are hanging there, most cells travel on through unless they touch those fibers. And if they touch those fibers, they get stuck by the fibers. And so it's kind of like a spider web, you know? If something travels past, those fibers are going to catch that cell traveling through. So you see these platelets here, they're traveling by, they got stuck by those fibers, and they're kind of like the firefighters. They put out a call for help. The call for help says to any other platelets passing by the area to stop off and cling to the clump. So why would you want to cling to the clump? What are you trying to do? Stop the bleeding. And so it's a temporary dam for that hole. Okay, so we have platelets flowing past. Their call for help is to one another to say, hey, we're clinging here, you know, we're hanging on, we're making a clump that keeps the blood from escaping. And of all parts of the blood, what are they really trying to keep from escaping? Right there. Yeah, blood cells. So they're trying to keep those red blood cells from squeezing their way out through that hole. There's a chemical they release. You may have heard of it before. It's called serotonin. It's a brain chemical too. It also helps for us to call for more platelets to come and clog up this area. It's a positive feedback loop. So how does that work? Do we want to enhance this process or stop the process?
Enhance.
Yeah. And in other words, what do we want to do to the clump that we're making here?
Bigger and bigger until it fills the hole.
Yeah, make it bigger and bigger, make your clump really large, and stick it to that hole, right, and say no more blood can escape out this hole. So you call for more and more platelets to come. That enhances this clumping process. We call it a platelet plug. So let's go back to your paper cut. If you've ever had a paper cut or a shaving cut, you may have stuck on a Kleenex or a piece of toilet paper and thought, I'll deal with that in a few minutes. And you may walk around your house with this paper stuck to you until somebody says, you know, what you got going on there? And you're like, oh yeah, I forgot. And then you just pull it off. What always happens when you pull it off? So what'd you rip off with it? The plug. So if you wait more than 3 to 5 minutes, you've pulled your plug off. And the platelets say, okay, we gotta start this again, right? So 3 to 5 minutes later, you might eventually get another platelet plug that is sealed up that hole. So the platelet plug is not the temporary solution. I mean, it's not a permanent solution. It is a temporary solution. We still have a gaping gap in that blood vessel. This platelet plug is not a permanent fixture. It's just a temporary stick a piece of chewing gum on it and go about your business kind of thing. So we now have to proceed to step 3, which is coagulation. And this step, we are going to build a really fancy-looking dam, and that's going to keep out anything from escaping, and we're going to give our blood vessel an opportunity to regrow. It may take a week or more for that blood vessel to regrow, so this better be a damn good dam, right? So this dam that we're building is actually a fibrin mesh network. You'll notice it looks like a fishing net. You see that? Okay, do you think these red blood cells can wiggle their way through that? Probably not. In fact, this is what it really looks like. So there's a red blood cell that got trapped in that fibrin mesh network. If you build this, those red blood cells cannot get out. And now your blood can flow through that vessel, and you're not going to have any trouble with the red blood cells escaping. You give your vessel time to repair the damage, and now you can then remove this clot that you've built inside. So this step here of making this fibrin mesh network is called coagulation. This is the third and final step of making a blood clot. And by 5 minutes after your damage, you've got one of these in place. 5 minutes, that's all it takes. So, you know, when they run stents up through vessels, like femoral arteries, now they go through like radial arteries and whatnot, you know, they take this huge needle out of your arm or your leg, they'll say put pressure on it. It's got to be at least 5 minutes, right? Because you've got to give an opportunity for this fibrin mesh network to dam off that blood flow. If you take the pressure off, which is the vascular spasm, then you may not have had an opportunity for the fibrin to build and the person then begins to bleed again. So at least 5 minutes must pass in order for us to have this final coagulation step take place. I'm going to go back to that screen that had all those words on it. The goal here is to go through a very complicated set of interactions. The goal that we're hoping to make is this last bullet point. We have all of these clotting factors that interact together. We're not going to learn all those clotting factors, but I would draw your attention to the last bullet point here. We're hoping to convert an inactive form called fibrinogen that's always in your bloodstream to a more permanent form called fibrin. Okay, so fibrinogen is the inactive form of fibrin. It's always in circulation, and only when you need it to clot your blood does it transform from its inactive state to the fully active state called fibrin.
So when you saw the picture of that netting, that was fibrin. I don't know how much you pay attention to your own scabs. I think, right. But if you happen to notice a scab that's in the process of doing this process, all of a sudden the blood looks like jelly. You ever notice that? If you've got jelly-like looking blood on a scab, you've got the fibrin mesh network. That is what's going to stop those cells from escaping, and it's going to hold until you repair the blood vessel. You re-knit that blood vessel back together. And again, see all these red blood cells and platelets get stuck in there like a really great spider web. And now it's a permanent enough of a fixture that over the next week you can regrow your vessel. But after a week's time has passed, when you've already finished off knitting your vessel back, do you need this in place anymore? So after about a week's time, this really awesome structure ends up getting torn down. Because if you were to leave this permanently in your vessel, what would happen to cells trying to travel through? It might be blocked, right. So this is a temporary, but a very, very good temporary structure to help us kind of solidify that vessel. Notice the words at the bottom of your page. Fibrinolysis is near the very bottom. When we finally decide that the vessel is repaired to our satisfaction, we come along and say, hey, this really awesome structure was great when we needed it. Don't need it anymore. Get rid of it. So we get rid of, break down the fibrin, thus the name fibrinolysis. And that means now that we can return to business as usual. So if this clot persists inside of a vessel that was once damaged, we call it a thrombus. Okay? So a thrombus is a stationary clot. Why is that bad?
Blood can't
get through, blood can't flow, right. So bad because you can't get blood past it. I don't know, probably worse yet is an embolus. Now the clot's where?
Moving in the bloodstream.
So a thrombus is a stationary clot, an embolus is a moving clot. So boy, oh boy, if that thing breaks free, it is like having scaffolding ramming through your vessels. And one of the worst places it can go is your heart or your brain, right? Because then we can cause brain damage, things like strokes, we can cause heart attacks, we can cause pulmonary embolisms. So we don't want this scaffolding to break free and go on a circulation ride through the body. Anticoagulants down there at the very bottom inhibit clot formation. They come in many forms. They don't all work the same way, but they all have the same goal, and that is to prevent this final fibrin mesh network from being formed. So they're commonly called blood thinners. Not the word we want to think about, right? Because thinning the blood means making the blood less viscous. These blood clotting agents here, these anticoagulants, don't technically thin the blood. They only inhibit blood clotting. So when you hear people say blood thinners, you should cringe and go, they're not really thinning the blood. They're actually just stopping this process here, step three, which is coagulation. All right, so test runs through page 34, and I was hoping to leave you more than about 7 minutes to ask questions, but the floor is yours. What do you need to hear for Tuesday's test?
Can you kind of explain like the sugar, the glucose, the glycogen, raises blood glucose, that whole cycle?
Sure. The take-home message is that insulin is the only one in that cycle that lowers blood sugar. Everything else raises blood sugar. And then let's talk about what you can store it as, because that kind of tells the story. So insulin is the only one of our hormones that lowers blood sugar. It takes glucose in our bloodstream and transforms it into a polysaccharide that we call glycogen. All right, so just want to make a mental note there that glycogen is a polysaccharide. It is not a fat. and we'll store glycogen for around 3 days or so in our liver and our muscles. After about 3 days, your body will then take that extra glycogen and store it as fat. So when you're looking for sugar in your body, the easiest thing to tap is blood glucose. So you will burn off blood glucose first. Okay. The next easiest place to get energy is from which of these other two sources? Glycogen is the second easiest step to tap. It is stored in liver and muscles, but to free it from your liver and muscles and turn it back into glucose, now what hormone do we need? Glucagon, that's right. So if you've burned through your available blood supplies of glucose, you've burned through your storage supplies of glycogen, your liver and muscles, you will now tap our third place for storing energy, and that's fat. So when you want to make some sugar and you have no more blood sugar, no more glycogen, you now take fat and you turn it back into glucose. But that's a different hormone that drives that mechanism. That's cortisol, that's right. Okay, and so there's names for these processes. Glycogenesis is making glycogen. Using cortisol has the neo word, right? Neo is new. So I remember that because sugar doesn't normally come from fat, but you can do the transformation. Breaking fat into sugar is gluconeogenesis. And what about breaking down glycogen into glucose? Yes, you're close. So catch the trends. Glycogen. Glycogen that has lysis. Okay, so just a couple of things here to follow with that one.
On page 28, there's blanks what I'm doing to enhance clotting.
Oh, I must have missed those completely. Vitamin K is one of those blanks.
And the other one is some kind of ion, do you know? Calcium, good. So vitamin K and calcium. Thanks for pointing that out. How about other questions for Tuesday that I can help review or answer for you?
Are a lot of the, like the multiple choice questions, are a lot of them going to be like scenarios?
There's some that are just basically, do you know the basic information? There are some scenarios in there, but they're not the majority of the questions. Some of the scenarios may end up as essays, but if you just basically know the content, that's really where I try to put the majority of the questions, is just at content level.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about tower drama and embolisms related to fibrinolysis?
Hold there. Oh, they're a failure of fibrinolysis. The reason you're going to have a thrombus or an embolism is because we failed to do fibrinolysis.
Okay, thank
you. Yeah, thanks for pointing that one out. That last question we didn't address, how are thrombi and embolisms related to fibrinolysis? They are failures. We did not properly break down the clot. Okay, so the test runs through page 34. If I can be of any help to you between now and Tuesday, please let me know. I'll be happy to chat with you in person or by email. All right, y'all have a good weekend.